Oscar Wilde once said, "Responsibility is what we expect from somebody else." This is very true. Most people dread accepting responsibility. That's just a fact of life, and we can see it in operation every day. We can see ourselves getting hot under the collar when the dentist keeps us waiting, and we're sitting there reading old magazines when our appointment was 30 minutes ago. And we don't stop to think that we forgot to mail in this month's mortgage payment. We can see ourselves growing angrier and angrier because a business contact is supposed to call at noon, and here it is almost 2 o'clock, and the phone still refuses to ring. But we don't stop to think about the calls we ourselves have forgotten to return while we've been so busy fuming. We can see ourselves writing an angry letter to the airline because a flight was delayed, but we don't write an angry letter to ourselves when we're late for something, even though that might not be a bad idea at all. Yes, we can see avoidance of responsibility all the time in both our personal and professional lives. And here's something else we can see just as often. We can see that most people aren't as successful as they wish they were. Do you see there's a connection between these two very common phenomena? I certainly do. And by the end of this session, I hope you'll agree with me. I hope you'll understand that it's in your best interest to take responsibility for everything you do. But that's only the beginning. I'm also going to suggest that many times it's even best to accept responsibility for the mistakes of others, especially when you're in a managerial or leadership role. I can hear you saying, "What? Accept responsibility for someone else's mess-ups? Why would I want to do something like that?" Well, that's a fair enough question, and over the next few minutes, I'll try to answer it. During the years when professional basketball was just beginning to become really popular, Bill Russell, who played center for the Boston Celtics, was one of the greatest players in the pro league. He was especially known for his rebounding and his defensive skills. But like a lot of very tall centers, Russell was never much of a free throw shooter. His free throw percentage was quite a bit below average, in fact. But this low percentage didn't really give a clear picture of Russell's ability as an athlete. And in one game, he gave a very convincing demonstration of this. It was the final game of a championship series between Boston and the Los Angeles Lakers. With about 12 seconds left to play, the Lakers were behind by 1 point, and Boston had the ball. It was obvious that the Lakers would have to foul one of Boston's players in order to get the ball back. And they chose to foul Bill Russell. This was a perfectly logical choice, since statistically, Russell was the worst free throw shooter on the court at that moment. If he missed the shot, the Lakers would probably get the ball back, and they'd still have enough time to try to win the game. But if Russell made his first free throw, the Lakers' chances would be seriously diminished. And if he made both shots, the game would essentially be over. Bill Russell had a very peculiar style of shooting free throws. Today, no self-respecting basketball player anywhere in America would attempt it. Aside from the question of whether it's an effective way to shoot a basket, it just looked too ridiculous. Whenever he had to shoot a free throw, the 6'11" Russell would start off holding the ball in both hands about waist high. Then he'd squat down, and as he straightened up, he'd let go of the ball. It looked like he was trying to throw a bucket of dirt over a wall. But regardless of how he looked, as soon as Bill Russell was fouled, he knew the Celtics were going to win the game. He was absolutely certain of it. Because in a situation like this, statistics and percentages mean nothing. There was a much more important factor at work. Something that no one has found a way to express in numbers and decimal points. Simply put, Bill Russell was a player who wanted to take responsibility for the success or failure of his team. He wanted the weight on his shoulders in a situation like this. No possibility for excuses. No possibility of blaming anyone else if the game was lost. No second guessing. Bill Russell wanted the ball in his own hands and nobody else's. And like magic, even if he'd missed every free throw he'd ever shot in his life before this, he knew he was going to make this one. And that is exactly what happened. That is what virtually always happens when a man or woman accepts responsibility eagerly and with confidence. I've always felt that accepting responsibility is one of the highest forms of human maturity. A willingness to be accountable, to put yourself on the line, is really the defining characteristic of adulthood. Anyone who has raised children knows how true this is. Just look at a baby during the first few years of life. Every gesture, every facial expression, every tentative word has one message for the baby's parents. The message is, I am totally dependent on you. I can't do anything for myself even if I try. I can't be held responsible for the consequences. After all, I'm just a baby. 10 or 12 years later, of course, as the boy or girl enters adolescence, this message to the parents will be very different. It will sound something like this. Why don't you just leave me alone? I want to be totally independent. I don't want to do anything but think about myself. I certainly don't want to accept any responsibility for anything beyond my own very well-defined needs and desires. It's only when we're at last grown up that the first two messages, I'm totally dependent on you, and I'm totally independent of you, finally turn into, you can depend on me, which is the truly adult outlook. Strange as it may seem, of course, there are people in their 30s and 40s who are still acting like adolescents, and there are even people in their 40s and 50s who are still acting like babies as far as their attitude toward responsibility is concerned. These kinds of people can be hard to have around, especially if you have to work with them. But the large number of people who shirk responsibility can also provide opportunities for you if you are determined to be different. If you decide to be one of the few who embraces responsibility, you can lead, and you will deserve to lead. Churchill said, responsibility is the price of greatness. And in my opinion, it's really a rather small price to pay. Let me be more specific about exactly what is involved in becoming a responsible person. It means, first of all, that you accept the consequences of your actions. But I'll go even further than that. Responsibility means you look to yourself as the source of everything that happens to you. It means that you assume command, regardless of the hardships you may have undergone early in life, or the prejudice you may have encountered, or the dozens of people who may have failed to understand you. Do you detect a note of irony in my voice, or perhaps a note of sarcasm? Do I sound hard-hearted? Do I seem to be denying the existence of difficult childhoods or of prejudice or of people who are insensitive to the needs of others? Well, that is certainly not my intention, nor is it my belief. I'm saying that regardless of the presence of those negative influences in your life, the best thing you can do, the most empowering thing, the strongest thing, and ultimately the wisest thing, is to accept responsibility for your own destiny, plain and simple. The benefits of this approach to life have been proven in some pretty dramatic ways. People who have been afflicted by serious illness, for example, appear to have a better chance of recovery if they decide to take responsibility for what has happened to them, despite the fact that it would be easier and perhaps even more reasonable to simply see themselves as victims of fate. There's a man, let's call him John, who had been healthy and vigorous all his life, who had started and sold businesses in a number of different fields, before finally deciding to enter law school in his late 40s. At that time, however, he began to suffer some severe health problems. All his life, his main focus had been on success and achievement, and he really hadn't paid much attention to what was happening to his body. For years, John subsisted largely on a diet of donuts and black coffee. And because he traveled a great deal, he also consumed large amounts of airplane food. Inexorably, he was gaining weight, 5 pounds 1 year, 10 pounds the next year, 15 pounds the year after that. Of course, John responded by opening a number of stores that featured clothing for overweight men. And he even used himself in his advertisements. In retrospect, this was probably a mistake. It gave him an incentive to gain even more weight. 1 year, John gained 20 pounds and actually bragged about that fact in his newspaper ads. Then he was diagnosed with severe diabetes. Although John's physicians assured him that the disease was brought about as much by heredity as by behavioral patterns, he was the kind of man who believed that he was the captain of his own ship. Not a common sailor taking orders from someone higher up. He was a man of strong character. And now, in the face of this new challenge, John resolved to begin taking responsibility for his own well-being. As he explains it, "All my adult life, I've been preoccupied with supporting my family and getting ahead financially. It was a sense of responsibility that I felt, and to a large extent, I've lived up to it. But I can see now that responsibility is beginning to express itself in a different way. Providing for my family is not just a matter of dollars and cents anymore. It's a matter of staying alive. It's my health, and it's the health of my family that's at stake as well." John continues, "I'm not setting a good example for my kids. They've seen me gaining weight. They've seen me literally brag about it in my advertisements. And lately they've been gaining weight themselves. I think in some sense they believe this is what I want them to do. And maybe they're not completely wrong. In fact, I've been thinking of including my kids in some new advertisements. And depending upon how it goes over, I've had it in the back of my mind to open up some clothing stores for overweight youngsters." John's eyes begin to light up at the thought of expanding his business and cashing in on new opportunities. But then he caught himself. And as he continued to speak, he pounded his fist on the table. "There I go again," he said. "I've gotten myself locked into a certain kind of thinking, and now I've got to get myself out of it. It's as simple as that." It was clear that John had indeed gotten himself locked into some well-defined thought patterns, but the most important one was the way he saw himself as the cause of everything that happened, not only in his own life, but in the lives of others. The doctors had told him his diabetes might have come on even if he hadn't been overeating and overworking, but John knew that was nonsense. And, as far as his kids were concerned, there have been a lot of news reports documenting the fact that American kids in general are heavier than they used to be. They just don't get the same amount of exercise as the children of previous generations. John could have resigned himself to the fact that his kids, like just about all kids today, are going to watch television, play video games, and eat junk food, whether he gained weight or not. But he didn't. "Baloney," he said. "It's all my fault, and I'm going to do something about it. In fact, I'm going to do a lot about it." And he did do a lot about it. John radically changed his diet and his lifestyle. He began ordering vegetarian meals on plane flights. He became a fitness enthusiast and ran several marathons. Although he ran rather slowly, as you might expect of a man in his 50s, he took pride in the fact that he always ran the course 3 times. On the day before the race, on the official race day, and again on the day after. instead of opening a clothing store for overweight children and using his own kids in the advertisement, he consulted a behavioral psychologist who helped him devise a system of financial rewards for his children that helped motivate them to bring their weight down. A system that taught them something about money at the same time. John is now in significantly better physical shape, is entering his final year of law school, and is negotiating with several companies to market his behavioral science techniques for reversing juvenile obesity. Sooner or later, all of us face situations in which we must decide whether to accept responsibility for a problem or look for ways to avoid responsibility. Assuming that you have, in fact, done something that has caused a problem of some kind, let's look at the various options and decisions that are now open to you. First, there's the role played by intention. In other words, was the outcome of your action what you intended it to be? And if it was not, should you still accept responsibility for that outcome? This is a very serious issue in the way we think about responsibility in our society. In many areas of criminal law, for instance, the intention to commit a crime must be present in order for the accused to be held criminally responsible. This intention is something quite different from mere negligence. If you leave your garden hose lying across the sidewalk so that the mailman trips over it and breaks his leg, you may be held responsible in a civil suit, but you would not be prosecuted as a criminal in the way you would be, for instance, if you had used a weapon in a robbery or an assault. But we don't have to enter a courtroom to see the important role intention plays in accepting responsibility ourselves or assigning it to others. Don't you remember when you were a kid and you left the screen door open so that the cat ran outside and was lost all afternoon? What did you say to avoid responsibility? You said, "I didn't mean to do that." You said, "It was an accident." As I pointed out earlier, there are lots of people who still use these childlike rationalizations well into their middle age. But if and when you decide you want to be an adult, you begin to see the whole question of intention as nothing more than another opportunity for excuse making, and you should refuse to participate in it. The great thing about excuses, and the really dangerous thing about them, is that no matter what happens, excuses are always there waiting to be used. Anybody can have an excuse for absolutely anything, and people have never been better at it than they are today. But the downside of excuses, even good ones, is that nobody really believes them. I don't care what people tell you, if you make excuses, they're going to know it, and they're going to think less of you. But if you refuse to rely on excuses, people are going to know that too, and they'll admire you for it. This is especially true in business. One of the classic examples happened about 15 years ago. A widely advertised healthcare product from a leading manufacturer was shown to be unsafe, and the company responded by pulling every single box off the shelves at a cost of millions of dollars. Was the company destroyed? Hardly. If they had done anything else, there would have been a tremendous loss of confidence, both on the part of consumers and employees. Instead, there was honest acceptance of responsibility for a mistake, and the public image of the company was dramatically enhanced. Contrast this with what happened recently to a leading manufacturer of computer chips. When a new microprocessor didn't perform up to expectations, the company made excuses. It was a minor problem, something that would crop up once in a lifetime, and so forth. Were these excuses valid? Maybe, maybe not. But it doesn't really matter, does it? So many people use excuses, but nobody really buys them. It's our modern version of the fable about the boy who cried wolf. In this case, the computer chip manufacturer finally took so much heat that they did replace the processors, which is what they should have done in the first place. An offshoot of the "I didn't mean to do it" excuse for evading responsibility is the "I wasn't myself at the time" excuse. This really deserves to be a category all its own, particularly since it's received so much attention in the courts, where it often occurs in the form of a defense based on temporary insanity or some other stress-related syndrome. A friend tells me about one day when she flew up from Texas to Los Angeles for a joint presentation that she'd be making along with a fellow from New York City. They had planned it all out very carefully over the phone. A lot of documents had been assembled. But they both knew that what really counts in face-to-face meetings is personal impression. On this score, my friend felt very confident about the L.A. meeting because her guy from New York City was an extremely charismatic personality. A burly and bearded man, always ready with a joke, he never wore a business suit, and his trademark outfit was a plaid shirt worn with the sleeves rolled up, a loosely knotted knit tie, khaki slacks, and loafers. His favorite expression was, "Let's get the show on the road," and he always said it with such gusto that he sounded like a 19th century wagon master starting a wagon train up the Oregon Trail. Most of all, he could sell refrigerators to the Eskimos. And of course, it was all because he was so good at selling himself. You can imagine my friend's extreme surprise and deep disappointment when this usually energetic ball of fire completely dropped the ball in their presentation. When they met in the client's outer office, my friend could hardly believe what she was seeing. The guy from New York was just sitting there, almost like a lump. He had no energy left whatsoever, like every bit of vitality had been drained out of him. When the meeting actually got underway, he seemed to grow even more lethargic, while my friend was left trying to pick up the slack. She was puzzled and could see also the incomprehension on the faces of the people she'd traveled all this way to meet. Here was this big guy in a plaid shirt, all but slumped over like the mouse at Alice in Wonderland's tea party. Was anybody going to invest money in that man's ideas? He seemed about as dynamic as a sack of potatoes. As you might expect, it wasn't long before they were safely outside the building, and my friend wasted no time in asking what in the world was wrong. In response, this usually energetic man in his lumberjack shirt said something about jet lag. It was all because of jet lag, he explained. He just wasn't himself. The flight from New York had been just too much. He'd feel better in a day or so, but for the time being, he was just not the man he normally was. He just wasn't himself. Well, it was all she could do to keep from laughing in his face. Here was a guy who looked like a wagon master leading settlers across the continent, and he was put totally out of commission by a first-class flight from New York City. What could she say? Jet lag? Is that the problem, she asked? Is that all? Well, not exactly, he replied. There is something else. Now she grew more concerned. Obviously, there was something deeply worrying this man. It could be anything. Maybe he'd been diagnosed with a serious illness, or perhaps someone in his family was ill. Maybe his house had burned down. Maybe he was in serious financial trouble. It's okay, she said, trying to sound calm for her own benefit as well as for her colleagues. Do you want to talk about it? He nodded. It's sad. Well, I'm sure it is, but I'm also sure you'll be able to handle it. For the first time all day, he smiled a weak little smile. No, he said, you don't understand. SAD is an acronym for Seasonal Affective Disorder. As my friend listened with amazement, he went on to explain that his jet lag had been worsened by the effects of Seasonal Affective Disorder, a mood disorder brought on by the short, chilly days of winter. You're out here in the West, where it doesn't really get all that cold, he concluded, sounding totally miserable. You don't really know what it's like. Of course my friend knew what it's like. We all know what it's like. And what it's like is excuses, evasion of responsibility, acting like a child, refusing to grow up. You can call it jet lag or sad or whatever you want, but it doesn't really matter what you call it. My friend wanted to tell him what she really thought of his psychobabble, but she knew what the class move really was here, and she wanted to make the class move because she wanted to be a strong character. And remember, a strong character assumes responsibility. If you want to be a leader, you must choose to assume responsibility for whatever happens, whether you have to or not. It's like being at the helm of a ship. You are responsible for everything that takes place on your watch. Don't worry about it, she said. I should have been ready to carry the meeting by myself. Next time, I'll be better prepared. Then she caught a cab back to the airport. Let me elaborate a bit further on the relationship between responsibility and leadership. Bear Bryant once said something about this issue. Bryant, of course, was the coach of many great football teams at the University of Alabama. And until his record was broken recently, he had the highest number of victories of any coach in the history of the game. Bryant said that from his point of view, it was impossible for any of his players to make a mistake during a football game. Any and all mistakes were his, because as coach he was solely and completely responsible for preparing his athletes to play error-free football. By saying this, Bryant was truly accepting a leadership role, and he was embracing the special category of responsibility that comes with it. As a leader, you've got to own responsibility for preparing subordinates for the challenges they'll face. And if the result is not successful, you've got to accept responsibility for not having prepared them adequately. Maybe this seems like a harsh standard to live up to, but that's just the way it is. If you can't handle responsibility and leadership, at least admit it to yourself and don't let other people start depending on you. Choose the standard you want to live by and follow through on. In the ancient world, during the time of the Roman Empire, there was an interesting attitude toward this kind of choice-making. It was a brutal world in those days, to say the least. Anything could happen, from plagues to revolutions, to barbarian invasions. Even for the upper classes, it was a challenge just to survive. Yet certain people attempted to do more. There was a tradition whereby people attempted to create themselves and their characters exactly the way an artist would create a painting or a sculpture. And like a work of art, these people looked upon their lives and their characters as things of beauty that would live on after their death, in the memories of their friends and families. People who chose to live their lives this way were not monks or ascetics, or in any way removed from life in the everyday world. They were just very serious about building strong character. In fact, the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius was a famous example of this type of person, and his journal is a powerful example of everything that's involved in building character and leadership. Much of it was written in military camps while the emperor was leading the Roman armies against barbarian tribes in what is now Germany. The writings of this ancient emperor and of the other people from the same period reflect a conscious choice to live according to certain standards of responsibility and character. This kind of clear decision about how to build your inner self is something that we rarely see today. Most people want to be good. They want to be ethical and moral and successful in every way. They want to fulfill their potential, but they think it's something that will just happen itself. They don't see that there should be a conscious, ongoing acceptance of responsibility for what you do and who you really are. There's an old saying that goes, I slept and dreamed that life was beauty. I woke and saw that life was duty. If you want to be really in control of your life, and if you want other people to be able to depend on you and look to you for leadership, you must wake up from the dream that somebody else will handle the pressure, that somebody else will shoot those two free throws. I slept and dreamed that life was beauty. I woke and saw that life was duty. Accepting responsibility doesn't mean that life can't be beautiful, but it does mean opening your eyes to the realities. A successful person not only must accept, but eagerly desires to accept. It means making a conscious decision to grow up, to let go of the dependency needs of childhood and adolescence, and recreate yourself as somebody other people can depend on. It means wanting the ball when the game is on the line. A duck walked into a large discount store, went up and down the aisles, filling a shopping cart with goods, and then pushed the cart up to the checkout area. The clerk took a look at the full shopping cart, and he was a little surprised by the large amount of stuff the duck had gathered. Will that be cash or charge? The clerk politely asked. The duck looked at him a little impatiently and said, Hey, I'm in kind of a hurry. Just put it all on my bill. Are you still listening? That was a joke. This is a session about humor and its role in character and leadership. So I thought it would be a good idea to start off with a joke. In fact, it's almost always a good idea to let people know you have a good sense of humor, because in this society, we take humor very seriously. And by the way, you do have a good sense of humor, don't you? I'm confident you'll answer in the affirmative, because virtually everyone is sure they have a good sense of humor, and we'll be talking more about that later. Right now, I just want to emphasize how important humor is as an aspect of strong character. Yet, if you were to ask 100 people to name character's most vital elements, I doubt if more than 5 would refer to humor. In fact, I don't think any would. When he wrote his classic study of American society in the early 18th century, the Frenchman, Alexis de Tocqueville, predicted that if the United States ever came to be ruled by a dictator, it would be someone with a well-developed sense of humor. If this is true, it's certainly a very different situation than you would find in any other country in the world. Think of the communist and fascist dictators who have played such a major role in 20th century history. They were not exactly a bunch of laugh-a-minute guys. They were good at projecting anger, and they were good at creating fear, but humor? No. Americans, however, respond to very different qualities in their leaders. And though they were obviously not dictators or tyrants, it's true that most of our beloved national leaders have had the ability to make others laugh and to laugh at themselves. Though he was fundamentally a rather melancholy man, Abraham Lincoln was also renowned as a humorist. Every biography of Lincoln refers to his love of funny stories and his willingness to stop and tell a joke, even in the midst of important business. And in more recent times, Presidents Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan were able to smooth out the ups and downs of their political careers with humor. And it was often directed at themselves. People could see that these men were strong enough and confident enough to make jokes at their own expense. And, as we'll discuss later, these men were also wise enough to apply humor carefully and at the right times. When we recognize those abilities in a person, we're able to believe they'll also be strong and confident in serious or even dangerous situations. In short, we as Americans see a well-developed sense of humor as an aspect of a strong character and as almost a prerequisite for leadership. But before you go out and buy a joke book as part of your personal self-development program, here's the bad news. To a great extent, you can't learn to be humorous. And that alone makes humor different from every other trait we've discussed in this program. There are many examples of people who learned to overcome fear or even downright cowardice, and who went on to become courageous leaders. There are fools who learned to be wise, and there are liars who turned into honest men and women. There are rigid thinkers who learned flexibility. But I personally have never encountered a humorless person who learned to be humorous. And if there were such a person, I'm sure I would have come across one by now, because I have certainly encountered a great many humorless people. Perhaps one reason we respond so strongly to humor in our leaders is because we associate it with honesty. And I think this association is well-founded. Real humor is honest because real humor can't be faked. You can pretend to be serious, just like you can pretend to be intelligent. You can always fake those qualities, and some people do it all the time, but you can't really pretend to be funny. The real irony, however, is that nobody feels like they have to pretend to fake having a good sense of humor, because everybody thinks that they actually have one. People will admit to almost anything before they confess to being humorless. Have you ever met anyone who said, "You know, I just don't know how to laugh. I just don't like it when things are funny. And I'm just much more comfortable being serious all the time." I've never met anyone like that, and I am very confident that I never will. In fact, if somebody actually confessed to me that he didn't have any sense of humor, I would think he must be joking. Take, for instance, a fellow named Sam. Sam was about as dour an individual as you would ever want to meet. He was in the meatpacking industry, which isn't an especially amusing occupation to begin with. And in his spare time, he was always trying to discover ways to make a quick $1 million. He had really been influenced by the hula hoop fad that swept the country during the summer of 1958. For some reason, that summer, all the kids in America decided they had to have hula hoops. And the company that manufactured them made a huge amount of money. Sam was captivated by this phenomenon. It really fired his imagination. Although he made very good money with his meatpacking business, he was determined to recreate the hula hoop. And he spent thousands of dollars trying to develop or find new toys. Some of them were very clever, but you had to be careful with them. There was one contraption that involved a block of wood on a string. I'm not sure how it was supposed to work, but if a kid wasn't careful and swung it around a little too fast, anybody standing nearby would be knocked cold. In any case, there was something very funny about seeing this totally humorless man, Sam, who was already quite wealthy, trying to make millions with silly toys. But after a while, there was also something a little sad about it, because there really was only one hula hoop fad, and Sam was clearly not going to recreate it. One day, a coworker of Sam's finally decided to have a talk with him. This coworker was quite a bit younger, so he approached Sam very deferentially, saying, "Sam, I'm a little confused. You're interested in making a lot of money on a new toy, but you're actually losing a lot of money trying to develop them or importing them from South America. Can you tell me a little bit about what you think is going on here?" "Well," Sam just looked at him and sighed. He said, "This business we're in is a pretty grim way of making money. I've got to have something going on the side. I've got to have something to keep my mind off making sausages and hamburger." To which the coworker replied, "Sam, I can certainly understand that, and I sympathize with how you feel, but you just don't seem to have a real knack for the toy business. Why don't you get involved with something that you're good at? Something that would let you use your natural abilities?" He was silent for a moment, thinking it over. When he concentrated like that, his chin sank down against his chest, and he looked like an old hound dog. He really seemed to have the weight of the entire world on his shoulders. He looked like he'd just lost his best friend in the world. Finally, he looked up and said, "Well, I've always had an excellent sense of humor. Maybe I could do something with that." Since that conversation, Sam has been trying his hand at writing scripts for television comedies. Wouldn't it be interesting? and disturbing if one of them were set in a slaughterhouse. You see, a man or woman will admit to anything before they admit to being a sourpuss. It just doesn't happen. But it's not like they secretly know they're humorless and are trying to keep it to themselves. It's not like they secretly know they have this great weakness, which is not having a sense of humor. That's not the way it is at all. No, every gloomy Gus really thinks he's a very funny guy. Sam the meatpacker was a perfect example of that. Like everybody else, he thought he had a very good sense of humor, and he even thought he might be able to cash in on it somehow. That's one of the reasons that humor is such a mysterious and elusive quality. We've all seen gangster movies where the head of the mob makes some terrible joke, and all the guys sitting around the table have to keep laughing until he lets them know it's safe to stop. That doesn't just happen among gangsters. That happens every day in the corporate boardrooms and congressional offices. It even happens around family dinner tables. Since everybody deeply believes that they have a good sense of humor, how can you find out if you actually don't? Unfortunately, you probably can't. It's just a very tough situation to deal with. Even your best friends won't tell you you're a humorless wet blanket. Fortunately, I'm not. I wake up every day feeling thankful for my good sense of humor, and in that sense, I'm sure I'm just like everybody else. We spoke a moment ago about the lack of humor that has characterized dictators throughout history. That's because real humor is almost always subversive. Humor undermines dictatorial power. It punctures balloons. It knocks people off pedestals. Nothing enraged Adolf Hitler more than Charlie Chaplin's portrayal of him in the movie called The Great Dictator. Chaplin, who was actually born on the same day as Hitler, did a fantastic job of capturing the dictator's every nuance and mannerism. This movie did more to alert the American people to the real nature of the Nazi dictatorship than any book or news report available at the time. Powerful people and the symbols of power that they like to accumulate are rarely humorous, at least intentionally. Think of those old Russian generals with all those rows of ribbons on their uniforms. Whatever else you might want to say about them, it was obvious that those uniforms were supposed to be very serious. A dozen rows of ribbons, a big red star on the hat, all sorts of gold braid hanging everywhere. Hey, this is no laughing matter. What a wonderful irony, then, that humor played an important part in the downfall of the Soviet Union. In the final years of the communist regime, political jokes became a highly developed art form in Russia and in all the countries of Eastern Europe. And the generals didn't get the joke until it was too late. The anti-government jokes that were circulating in the Soviet Union during its final years were an example of a particular kind of humor. They were designed to elicit a very specific response, which we can call the laughter of ridicule. This is really a form of hostility disguised as mirth. It's intended to be very destructive to its target, and at the same time it serves as a kind of survival mechanism for the joke teller and his listener. It allows them to express their anger indirectly. If you're ever in a leadership position and you find that this kind of hostile humor has been directed at you, I strongly suggest that you do one thing immediately. And I'm not going to suggest that you take action to suppress the jokes. Instead, you had better ask yourself what you've been doing to provoke this kind of response among your subordinates. And once you figure it out, I suggest that you change that behavior immediately. Laughter of ridicule is a very bad sign for a leader. It's one kind of humor that should be taken very seriously. There are several other categories of laughter that we should consider as well. Have you ever gone to a comedy movie and noticed that the audience starts laughing even before anything funny happens? A leading comic actor can simply come on the screen and make a bland remark about the weather, and everyone in the audience will start laughing. I've seen this happen many times with people like Robin Williams and Steve Martin. Underlying this kind of laughter is a desire on the part of people to have a shared experience. They want to participate in the experience together. I call this the laughter of community. Another kind of laughter that can be observed at the movies is something I call laughter of recognition. This occurs when someone wants to show that they get the joke. They see how something was intended to be funny, even if less informed people don't see it. This kind of laughter is especially common among younger audiences, and many members of the older generation find themselves frequently missing out on it. Irony is the basis for so much humor today. And by its very nature, irony is intended to exclude a certain percentage of people. The rest of them laugh to show that they've been admitted to the club. They laugh to show they recognize the joke, and therefore deserve to be recognized as members of that select group. That's why I call it laughter of recognition. Polite laughter is yet another category. This is sort of a social non-laughter that one gets when a laughing response is called for, but isn't really motivated. We've all had the experience of telling a joke that doesn't really go over too well and elicits only polite laughter. And we've all responded to such jokes with polite laughter of our own. It's just a gesture that keeps the ball rolling, but it's an important one. Nobody likes to be on the receiving end of polite laughter. But it's better than being poked in the eye with a sharp stick, to quote an old joke. The last and most important category of laughter I'll mention might be called real laughter. It's spontaneous, it's happy, it's unpremeditated, it has no hidden agenda. It happens when you see or hear something that's really funny. I'd like to spend a moment talking about this category of real laughter because it's one of the most important aspects of humor. The more real laughter you can bring into your life, the better off you'll be. I've spoken quite a bit about children and the raising of children in this program, and kids are really our best source of knowledge about real laughter. They really put their whole selves into it. We lose that to a large extent as we get older, and I'm not sure that loss can be completely avoided. For example, think about someone, one of your own kids, a neighbor or a niece or nephew that you've watched grow up. Whatever interest this person pursues today, it's likely that he or she was a budding artist in the early years. Crayons, markers, and pads of paper are standard issue in most households with young kids. And those kids draw big, beautiful pictures with all sorts of colors and patterns. At that age, there are no rules about keeping inside the lines and using certain colors for certain objects. Those pictures that grace refrigerators across the country are examples of artistic genius. Then when kids grow to about 5 or 6 years old, their drawings change. They begin drawing stick figures standing next to houses that consist of a triangle on top of a square. Kids this age are still just as proud of their drawings and actually see them as a big advance over the ones they'd done as babies. And they are more advanced in some ways, but they're also less free. There's a sense of responsibility about them, an effort to put everything in the right place and make everything the right color and the right size. In addition, around the same time as these kids' drawings change, their laughter changes too. It's still delightful, but there's more awareness in it. I guess that's just the way it's got to be. As the British poet William Wordsworth put it, though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass and glory in the flower, we will grieve not, but rather find strength in what remains behind. I'm sure kids have a lot of concerns and worries that seem as big to them as ours do to us, but they really don't have a lot of responsibilities. They really don't have bills that have to be paid by tomorrow, or presentations or phone calls that can make your palms sweat. It's those kinds of responsibilities that suppress real laughter as we get older. And there's simply no avoiding it. But we should try to bring real laughter into our lives as much as we possibly can. It's good for the soul. And there's even been evidence that heartfelt laughter has the ability to benefit physical health. Let me say a few practical things about the role of humor in leadership, particularly in business or management situations. Have you ever noticed how certain jokes seem to suddenly appear in the business community, circulate for a while, and then they gradually disappear? Where do these jokes come from? How do they get started? You'll hear them at the start of meetings or conferences when everybody is trying to get settled down. During the course of 1 week, you can have meetings in Los Angeles, Phoenix, Indianapolis, and Boston, and hear the same joke in every one of those meetings. There's something almost eerie about it. In any case, these business meeting jokes really have some important functions. First, they're sort of a bonding ritual, where everybody shows that they share a sense of humor and that they like to laugh about the same things. I think that function is pretty obvious. But there's another function of jokes that's more subtle but extremely important. In a way, they're intended to rid the situation of humor. Once the joke has been told, the humor has been encapsulated or compartmentalized within that joke, and it won't be seen again until the meeting is over. That's why it's good to begin a very serious discussion with a joke. After the moment of humor has been experienced through the joke, seriousness can reign for the balance of the meeting. I've seen this phenomenon take place many times. If you handle it correctly, then telling a joke can really reinforce your image as a serious person. Once the joke is out of the way, you can be as intense as you want for as long as you want, because all humor has been compressed into the joke, and now the joke is over and done with. There's an important distinction to be made between the leader who tells jokes and a very different kind of person who I'll call the funny guy. And let me point out very quickly that the funny guy is almost always a guy. I don't believe I've ever come across a woman in business who fills this role. I'm not sure why that's true. In any case, the funny guy is someone who doesn't seem to understand that the role of jokes is to reinforce the seriousness of the rest of the interaction. He doesn't understand that a joke is really a kind of scapegoat that forms the center of a little ceremony for a moment and then is banished once and for all. No, the funny guy is someone who keeps telling jokes, who keeps reintroducing humor into a situation from which everyone else has tried to banish it. I can honestly say that I've never met an effective leader whom I would identify as a funny guy. And it's even worse for the funny guy if he actually is funny. Then he's just a clown, and clowns simply are not given leadership positions in any organization. The leaders I spoke of earlier, Roosevelt, Kennedy, Reagan, used jokes and witticisms to demonstrate their humanity and to diffuse hostility, but they were by no means funny guys. Often their jokes and quips weren't even really funny. They were symbols of humor rather than real examples of it. And even this largely symbolic version of humor was applied very carefully. If it had been otherwise, these men would never have achieved a leadership role of any kind, let alone that of President of the United States. Most funny guys didn't start out that way. They're generally people who have been passed over several times and are using humor to help them cope with their disappointment. And there's also an element of anger in most funny guys, though it's usually deeply hidden, and they may not even be consciously aware of it. By continuing to be funny in situations where it's no longer appropriate, the funny guy may unconsciously be trying to subvert the goals of the group. Effective leaders recognize this, and they see to it that funny guys are denied any real responsibility. Once again, And as with the other qualities we've discussed in this program, there's something paradoxical in our attitude toward humor. We want to discover humor in other people, and we want to find it in ourselves, but we don't want too much of it. And in certain situations, we don't want any of it at all. Leaders intuitively understand the role of humor, and they apply it in the right amounts at the right times. They understand that, as with many of the other good things in life, too much of a good thing is almost as bad as none at all. Earlier I suggested that to a large extent humor is something that you either have or you don't, that unlike many other self-development skills, it's very difficult to improve your capacity for humor. But if that's true, doesn't it suggest that there's something self-contradictory about this whole discussion? After all, what's the point of talking so much about humor if there's really very little you can do towards strengthening your capacity for it? Well, it may be true that you can't increase the natural proportion of humor in your personality beyond a certain preordained point. But that's not the end of the story. You can still learn to have a basically humorous approach to life, or perhaps playful would be a better word. And I think the ability to do so is an extremely important indicator of strong character. Modern physics has demonstrated that light can act as either a particle or a wave. If we design an experiment based on light behaving like a wave, we will find that it does indeed behave like a wave. If we design another experiment in which light is supposed to behave like a particle, it sure enough behaves like a particle. So what really is the true nature of light? There is no simple answer to that question. It's all a matter of perception and expectation. In the same way, life can be either a comedy or a tragedy, and it's always in your power to determine how you want to see it. I prefer to see it as a comedy, and I highly recommend this to you also, but let me explain exactly what I mean by that. I don't mean to suggest that life is a comedy like you see on television at 8 o'clock on Channel 5. I'm using comedy according to the classical definition of the term, as a progression from sadness to happiness, from a low point to a high point, from poverty to wealth in every sense. In literature, the best example of comedy in this sense is Dante's Divine Comedy. Although I don't believe there is a single joke in that entire work, it's a comedy in the sense that the story begins in hell and ends in paradise. Yet most people don't even know that Dante wrote two more volumes that take place after the completion of the Inferno. History has chosen to focus on the frightening, painful part of Dante's poem, and if you're not careful, you may find yourself doing the same thing in your own life. We live in a time that has equated seriousness with intelligence, unhappiness with sensitivity, and victimization with moral authority. In short, we have largely chosen to see life as tragic rather than comic. But to the extent you participate in this, I believe you are limiting your potential for success in the material sense, and, even more importantly, you are doing nothing for your character, or at least nothing good. Humor can be your best tool for distancing yourself from the negativity and pessimism that's so rampant today. It's not always an easy tool to use, but I believe its importance has been seriously underestimated as an element of strong character. George Bernard Shaw said that everything is funny as long as it happens to someone else. But a really strong person is able to laugh even when the joke's on him. Just as light will conform to various kinds of experiments, if you choose to find humor in life and in your own circumstances, you will find it. If you're of strong enough character to see life as a comedy, in the sense I've described, you are strong enough to make it really be that way as well. And I'm very serious about that.